We're on. Well, good afternoon, and welcome to the first day of the legislative session and the first meeting of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. Let's see, we're going to start off here with the organizational things. First item is adoption of the committee rules. They're the standard. Has everybody had a chance to take a look at them? Okay, the chair moves adoption as the rules is presented. Discussion on the motion? Is there any objections to the motion? The rules are adopted. All right. I don't know if we need to do introduction of members. We're still missing two. I think we're going to pass right over that, and we're going to go down to... Are we going to do introduction of bills now? Committee measures?
Now or at the end?
Let's do it at the end. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 76. James?
Senate Bill 76 eliminates the filing with Secretary of State for consular corporation credentials, merges requirements dealing with registration, recording, and fees for union labels and fraternal insignia that affect the Secretary of State Corporation Division with requirements for trademarks, repeals requirement for business to file with the Secretary of State an intent notice for going out of business sale, requires businesses to self-generate and post the notice that they are currently filed with the Secretary of State, declares emergency effective on passage, becomes operative January 2016. There are no revenue or fiscal impacts.
All righty. Do we have a sign-up list? Yes. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Peter.
Okay. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peter Threlkill. I'm the director of the Secretary of State's Corporation Division, and it's my pleasure to speak with you today about Senate Bill 76. Really, we look at this as a cleanup bill, and part of what we're cleaning up are old, obscure statutes that really no longer apply. I think this is a fairly important thing to do every once in a while. So the bill repeals and streamlines unnecessary, obscure, and seldom used business laws that will lessen the regulatory burden on businesses in Oregon. The first thing it does is it eliminates the notice of going out of the notice of intent for holding a going out of business sale. A few years ago, the legislature passed a law around sham sales, and right now we have a handful of businesses that are posting or coming to us and filing the notice. They're basically Sears Corporation and the Kmart Corporation as they're closing out and shutting down stores. So that's the extent of who's doing the filings. There are enforcement provisions that apply to the Department of Justice. Those still stay in the law if you were to adopt this bill. Basically, it just says that here are the requirements for the business. They self-generate a notice, they post it up, and then they still have their 90 days to hold their sale and wrap up their business and move on. The next part of the bill addresses union labels and fraternal insignia. Now, these can be a design, a label, a term, a badge, a mark, a motto, an emblem, or a button. Essentially, they're trademarks, and Oregon has a trademark law. The trademark law was really updated, modernized, came into effect after the union label and the fraternal insignia laws were created about 100 years ago. So this kind of brings the processes back into a little bit more alignment. We haven't had a union label filed in 22 years, 13 years for fraternal insignia. It just changes the process so that the filers will file like they're doing a trademark, as opposed to this sort of a one-off process that they do or they would do today or a decade or so ago. And finally, the bill repeals a never-before-used provision for certifying consular corps credentials. A consul is an official of a foreign government that's here to represent the interests of that government's citizens and help with trade matters. We've never been asked to certify consular corps credentials in the 32 years that this law has been on the books. I don't think that it's one of those things that's really proven to be that needed. So That's my testimony, and I would be happy to answer any questions you have.
No, we do have a few of them in the area, though. Questions? Senator Ryan.
Thank you. The first thing you mentioned was the going out of sale, and you said that the enforcement stays in place for folks who have these sham going out of sale, going out of business sales. How are those handled? How are they investigated? Do you know that answer?
Chair Beyer, Senator Riley. Yeah, the enforcement provisions are with the Attorney General's Office in the Department of Justice. So in their consumer protection program, they take the complaints. If an individual or other business files a complaint, they do the investigations there. They contact the people that are holding the sale and do all the follow-up and enforce the law that applies.
Follow-up.
So this only removes the requirement to file an actual going out of sale or going out of business sale. Is that right?
It just the requirement to file that notice with the Secretary of State.
Okay. Thank you.
There you go. Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Peter. Is there anybody else? That's all I had signed up. You want you to just hang on a second. Is there anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 76? Don't see any. Pretty simple bill, so we will close the public hearing. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 76. Chair moves Senate Bill 76 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Is there any opposition? Senate Bill 76 is passed unanimously to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Thompson, would you like to carry this one?
Sure.
There you go.
Fitting bill.
We will close on that. We will. Which one is Senator Farrow over here for?
140.
Okay. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 140. Would you give us a name?
Senate Bill 140 extends sunset date for the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council from January 2nd, 2016 to January 2nd, 2020. There is no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact, and no amendments.
Senator Ferraioli, welcome to our committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. State Senator Ted Ferraioli, District 30. If I may, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, when I was appointed to the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council, I rolled my eyes and thought this was going to be the worst exercise I'd ever been forced to participate with and in, because I thought that the basis for Senate Bill 140 was a sort of a social engineering issue about forcing broadband access into areas through market distortions and mandates. Boy, was I wrong. What has occurred is one of the most fascinating committees that I've ever served on, and I've served on a bunch of them in the last 18 years. But the thing that I found the most interesting was there was absolute willingness, more than willingness, eagerness for participants from the private sector and the public sector to get together to discuss issues of technology, of communication, of emergency communication, of emerging technology, and essentially all aimed at providing legislators with a clear snapshot of what's happening in, you know, the almost incomprehensible world of the expansion of information technology. And to that end, this committee has dedicated itself to airing issues of emerging technology from interoperability to the spread of high technology, high speed internet access all across the state of Oregon in some surprising ways, all driven without mandates from the state government, all driven by the desire for the private sector to get out there, beat their competition, and serve the need. You'll hear about that from our committee administrator, but I just wanted to tell you that this is an opportunity to remove a sunset and to create the continuation of an information flow that I think we need to have. You know, I, like you members, have a shelf full of reports to the legislature that never make it outside the shrink wrap. This one is one worth reading because it'll tell you things that you, I guarantee you, you do not know about the information revolution as it's been being expressed in the state of Oregon. It's more than 25 things you don't know about high-tech communication in the state of Oregon and broadband service particularly. Well worth reading, and it's an indication of some really good work done by the committee. So I would suggest, and members, I implore you really to go ahead and lift the sunset. This is a very small expenditure of public resources, but it's a huge product in terms of information that you need to make decisions about information technologies.
Thank you. Questions of the senator? It must be important. It's the first time I have you heard you express the need to not sunset a state agency.
This is one, this is one in a row. Thanks for noticing, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Senator.
You bet.
Mr. Tamarin. I did ask you to do this, didn't I?
Good afternoon. Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Gerard, Committee. My name is Christopher Tamarin. I'm with the Oregon Business Development Department, and I provide staff support to the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council, and I came today to answer any questions you might have about the council. Briefly, the council was created in the 2009 legislative session. The mission is to encourage coordination and collaboration between organizations and economic sectors for the development and utilization of broadband. The council members are appointed by the governor. They represent Oregon's cities, counties, telecommunications service providers, tribes, educators, economic development organizations, public safety agencies, healthcare providers, government and the Public Utility Commission. Also, Senator Ferrioli and Representative Clem serve on the council. The council provides a statewide forum for the discussion and exploration of broadband issues. The council is unfunded. To date, the council has convened 50 times to discuss and deliberate and report on broadband issues and economics, technologies, and public policy as they relate to the interests of Oregonians. The council has prepared and submitted broadband in Oregon reports to the Legislative Assembly and the governor in 2010, 2012, and 2014. It also produced the Gas and Electric Utilities Broadband Deployment Report and the Broadband Outreach Survey in 2012. The council has also participated in several state broadband data and development program federal grant projects that were administered by the Public Utility Commission. It's participated in the Oregon Broadband Mapping Project and in the Broadband Strategic Planning Project and a Broadband Adoption Survey. All of the OBOC reports and projects are posted on the council website at www.broadband-oregon.org, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Questions? Senator Durant.
Yeah, I took a symposium down in California, and they were concerned about running out of the ability of broadband, the capacity of broadband. What are you doing to make sure that we don't run out of capacity? I know sales are extremely expensive of broadband widths, and it's kind of scary, the technology. You know, it used to be a few bytes that we needed, and now it's into the gigabytes and who knows what else. And so, what's that?
Terabytes.
Terabytes, yeah. So what are we doing to make sure that we're going to have adequate amounts? And if we have to ration, what are we going to do and how are we going to do it?
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair, or Chair Gerard, Chair Beyer. What you might have heard reference to is running out of Internet Protocol IP addresses. And that would be IP version 4, which was the address scheme for the ARPANET, which then, when made public, became the Internet. And those number of addresses were reaching exhaustion. In fact, I think they are all committed now. There's an international body that manages those addresses. They're moving towards an Internet Protocol version 6, which has vastly increased the number of addresses available, and there have been some other schemes to increase the capacity in IP v.4. So that's one area of capacity, and my guess is that's probably what you had heard reference to as being something that might need be a hard restriction on the Internet. That's been addressed by those international bodies. In terms of capacity, the Internet infrastructure, I think, broadband infrastructure will be a continuous work in progress going forward. It has become the platform for business and for education and for communication is essential infrastructure for the state. The state's private sector providers are aggressively investing in new infrastructure. The federal government has introduced a number of programs to support and encourage continued infrastructure development in the country as a whole, and Oregon has been taking advantage of those. So, and just last week, the FCC issued a ruling increasing the definition of broadband now to be 25 megabits per second downstream, 3 megabits per second upstream, increased from what was established in the National Broadband Plan about 5 years ago or so at 4 meg down and 1 meg up. So I would say don't worry about capacity. The service providers are very tuned in to the market demand, which is exploding. And is continuously working to make sure capacity is available to serve all those paying customers.
Well, I want to tag on to that. I was at a meeting last week with a bunch of business people and university people in Eugene, the regional solutions team, and Representative Nathanson had brought the issue up from a meeting she had, and they actually were saying something different, Chris. They were saying, particularly the developers, software developers in the Eugene area, were talking about being constrained by a lack of capacity for a large volume, big data. And the researchers, in terms of there's big data, the ability to get it out. And I know that Oregon State and U of O are actually talking about trying to get to the Sacramento gateway as opposed to everything trying to go through the Portland gateway of the Internet.
Yeah. Senator Beyer, I attended a meeting with Representative Nathanson last week when I was my remarks to Vice Chair Girard was talking about the Internet as a whole and capacity and the networks. But as I said, the infrastructure is always a work in progress. And when you get down to any specific address, service address, there could be limitations there in the bandwidth that's available. City of Eugene is interested in developing its high-tech sector and its software sector. And they're working on fiber access to, I think, a couple of key buildings in the downtown area that they're concerned about. That's stimulating that conversation down there. But the infrastructure is always a work in progress. I think what we we conceive to be broadband is going to continue to expand in terms of speed over time. Up until just 2008, the FCC defined broadband as any digital service providing at least 200 kilobits per second in one direction.
Kind of a joke.
Of course, that's we've come a far away since then, and now we have the city of Sandy, the cities of Monmouth and Independence, in Portland, moving to become gigabit cities, providing gigabit services, which is 1,000 megabits per second to subscribers. So, those activities and those interests and specific service sites and locations, again, that will always be a work in a progress, and we can always improve. And our expectations, our bar for what we want as customers and users, I think is going to continue to increase over time.
So is the Broadband Council exploring and dealing with these issues and bringing them back up for public policy consideration?
On several levels, yes. One of the number of the challenges and opportunities that the Broadband Council has identified in its report includes broadband strategic planning by at the local community level. And the council views that as very important if we look around different areas of the state to where exciting things have happened with regard to broadband deployment. It's you know, a common theme is that there are local champions, like Representative Nathanson, that see a need and want to improve the level of services available and address it. So the council is promoting broadband planning at the local community level. Another key area is in K through 12 education. There is a wide range of service availability to the state's school districts. Some districts are in very good position with fiber to all their schools and high levels of capacity. Others do not. Just in this past year, 2014, the FCC issued enhancements to the E-rate program, which is a program to subsidize the cost of broadband services for K through 12 schools and libraries. And they took two important steps. One is that they increased the budget by just over $1 billion in each of the next 2 years to increase that subsidy, and that program now will also support infrastructure in the school and on the campus beyond just the network access for services. So, the council is engaged and will be engaged in this coming year in promoting a number of federal programs for broadband-related activities, significant dollars in the billions of dollars, and promoting the availability of those programs to eligible applicants within the state.
Thank you. Other questions?
Thank you very much, Chris.
And let's see, who else do I have here? Patrick Singh and Craig Hanman, you both want to come up at the same time? League of Cities and Association of Counties.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Singh. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. High-speed internet access and affordable access is very important for Oregonians. It's something that we've been working on through the association. Broadband access not only needed for information dissemination, but very important public safety and economic development factors are in play as well. The council, as you've heard from the previous two speakers, is a very important platform for these discussions to take place. We happen to be represented by Sherman County Commissioner Mike Smith, who also has a business that operates on the internet. So access is very important in what he does on a daily basis. The testimony that we submitted on OLIS has an article from the National Association of Counties article that, if you get the time to read, will show a public-private partnership that was highlighted in Sherman County where broadband access was provided to all citizens in the county for a very affordable rate. So with the council, we hope that these types of partnerships can continue. So we ask for your support in extending the work of the council. Thank you very much.
I think that one was put together way back when by a guy named Ray Baum, former legislator, in his attorney role, for the good judge over there. Anyway, Craig, go ahead.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Craig Honeyman, legislative director for the League of Oregon Cities. I'm going to have an opportunity to visit with Ray Baum next month when a league delegation goes back to Washington, and we talk about telecommunications issue with his boss, Congressman Walden. I'll be brief. I'm here as a frequent, if not regular, attendee of the OBAC monthly meetings, the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council monthly meetings, and I'm here to support Senate Bill 140, the extension of the sunset. One of the more valuable elements of their work are the biennial reports that they are required to provide you, the legislature, on the status of broadband deployment in Oregon. And the league helps Chris and the staff put together that report, especially as it relates, obviously, to city government issues, most importantly, the use of e-government citizen interface with their local governments through technology, through use of the internet, permitting, et cetera. But OBAC is also a source of great information on what is happening in a rapidly changing world of technology, especially in the area of the federal rules and regulations, mapping existing technology or broadband deployment in the state of Oregon for purposes of identifying especially where there are gaps and opportunities. And it's an opportunity for local governments to interface with the private sector and work collaboratively and in coordination with the private sector to leverage the deployment of broadband technology around the state, especially in the areas of education, workforce development, general government, health care, all of which contribute to the economic vitality and development of communities. OBAC also promotes broadband adoption by citizens and individual communities, which I represent. So they're a valuable resource to us as we go forward in keeping up with the times in terms of technology. So without hesitation, the League wishes to register its support for Senate Bill 140. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of Patrick or Craig? Gina, thank you very much. That's all that I have signed up on my sign-up list here. Witness, is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 140? Nobody from the long carriers that are in the audience? Apparently not. All right, so we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 140. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 140. The chair moves Senate Bill 140 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator.
You gave kudos to Ray Baum, who is a fellow Republican that I served on, and I just think we should give kudos to Al Gore, the person that discovered the Internet.
The inventor of the Internet? Well, it's very bipartisan to you, Senator.
I thought I'd throw that in there.
Other serious comments, discussions. Seeing none, is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, Senate Bill 140 is moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation by unanimous vote of the committee. And Senator Girard, since you obviously have an interest in this issue, would you like to carry this?
Oh, I'd love to.
Okay, we are closed. Senator Girard will carry. We'll move back up and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 77. James.
Senate Bill 77 prohibits the formation of incorporation of a corporation sole in Oregon on or after effective date of measure, grandfathers existing corporation soles contingent upon renewing registration, declares emergency effective upon passage. There is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. No amendments.
Thank you. Peter?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Peter Threlkeld, Director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State's Office, to speak with you about Senate Bill 77. The bill eliminates future filings of an obscure type of tax-free nonprofit corporation that is used by tax evaders and promoters of tax evasion schemes primarily. The corporation sole is currently allowed in Oregon and 9 other states. Most of the remaining states have eliminated this type of nonprofit registration. It originates back to at least the 1400s as a way for the bishop or the abbot of a church to hold and pass along the assets of the church. Historically, it was employed by established religious denominations like the Roman Catholic Church. Oregon's corporation sole provision is ORS 65.067, and it allows a religious organization to appoint one person to hold those assets and be the sole financial officer, whereas a traditional nonprofit corporation requires a independent three-person board of directors at minimum. The few legitimate religious organizations that maintain corporation sole status, but most have adopted to move to the traditional nonprofit corporation form. Our traditional nonprofits, the laws came into effect well after the 1400s, or when these other, the corporation sole form was originally accommodated. And the benefits of moving to that traditional form is that the nonprofit corporation has continual existence. So it doesn't have to transfer its asset. It gets to hold them in perpetuity because it never expires or goes away. It also has the benefit of better fiduciary oversight through that independent board of directors. The IRS has highlighted corporation SOLs as being frequently used by individuals for making frivolous tax arguments and attempting to improperly avoid income taxes. Of the 270 active corporation SOLs with the Secretary of State, 175, or 65% of them, were filed by promoters of these tax evasion schemes just in the last 3 years alone. The bill provides that a corporation SOL may not be formed after the effective date. All existing corporation SOLs are grandfathered in, so they get to continue their existence as long as they maintain their status with the state of Oregon. That's my remarks. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Peter, you touched on the history with religious institutions, particularly the Roman Catholic Church. Has there been any discussion with that organization or any other religious organization in terms of impact?
Yes, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, we did reach out to the Roman Catholic Diocese. They had no objections to the bill. They appreciated us coming out. We also reached out to Protestant organizations and have heard no concerns or feedback of any opposition.
Senator?
Yeah, I understand the problem, but it seems to me instead of banning it outright, we could just write it, a little bit tighter. When you mention religious organizations and you want to do away with some type of entity altogether, and 35% of them, by your own admission, are legal, I have a lot of angst with that. And reaching out to a church, or the Catholic Church in this case, who is grandfathered in this bill, they have no impact. So it would have to be some future church or some future reference. So I don't understand why we just can't tighten up the language instead of banning them outright, or put restrictions on it so that, that perhaps that if we tighten it up so that it wouldn't be used as a tax loophole.
Chair Beyer, Senator Jarrett. Part of what we looked at was really that the vast majority of the religious organizations are just coming in and forming as regular nonprofit corporations. They're not even giving consideration to the corporation SOL. And again, a lot of that goes back to you have that continued existence, and you have the members of the church serving as boards of directors, your appointed deacons, your other people that act as the overseers, and they're providing that oversight to the organization. So, I mean, just a lot of them have really looked at that as we've made that available to them. There's really less of a need for this, archaic form of organization.
Peter, I would guess that the strength, if I heard you correctly in your presentation, is that the newer form of not-for-profit, the difference being that in the corporation SOL, you have to have a process to, when you're moving from one individual to another, for example, when the archbishop or the diocese changes, you have to go through some process. In the situation of a not-for-profit, it's the archdiocese that would be the corporation, I assume.
Right.
And so you wouldn't have to have the change on people. The organization would continue, and you have a board of directors that goes with it.
That's correct. It's really around how the assets are held. And if the assets are held by the individual as the bishop, when that person retires or passes away, there has to be a process to transfer those assets to another individual. And that just doesn't exist in nonprofit corporation status because it's a separate legal person. That entity maintains its perpetual existence. So it doesn't go away until the board decides that they want to dissolve it.
So I'm curious, in a situation where we'll choose that, God forbid, the archdiocese, if the bishop unexpectedly dies, how would they go about transferring those assets if it was held by that person?
So the organization would come back and they would appoint a new overseer.
Hmm. Okay. Senator?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Back to the original question. Can you give me an example of how they're using this as a scam? I'm trying to get my hands on why we have to do this, and I'm still back to the 35%
certainly
that are legal. So,
one of the there's a belief, but it's a misguided belief that because any income or any assets that come into the corporation sole are automatically tax exempt by the IRS, that you don't have to make annual filings and you get to avoid all that. The proponents will provide information, and in many cases it's a kind of an ongoing relationship. There's one that will charge its clients $300 a year to continue to maintain this and provide consulting advice. But some of the things they'll talk about is that you, the individual, that the corporation's sole can hire you out as labor or to a business, and that the payments are made back to the corporation's sole. So it's not income that you individually earned. It's a donation to the religious organization that can be a write-off, as well as, because it's made to the organization, it's tax-free. So they tend to fall into the category of very frivolous tax arguments, but there's these promoters are out there. They're charging, the one that's charging $300 a year on an ongoing basis. There's others that charge $2,000, $3,000 for a one-time setup. And certainly there are people that are falling for this, but they're also getting, those folks are getting taken advantage because, it's just not a valid tax argument, and it also, creates conflict or raises concerns with the taxing authorities, so did that answer your question?
Well, sort of, but not really.
Okay.
The not really part is, are they trying to be a church? Is that it? They're setting themselves up to be a soul.
It doesn't have to be a church, just a not-for-profit
religion.
Well, we're talking about it's a religious tax. We are talking about religion here.
It is. I mean, they do hold themselves out as a religion, but there's a certain segment of society that believes that they're not beholden to the laws of man. They're only beholden to the laws of a higher authority. And, so they'll use these arguments to say that, and theoretically, it's, they tend to be quite popular around the laws that they really don't like are the laws around taxation, but they also apply them for other laws, whether it's registering your vehicle at the Department of Motor Vehicles or following the rules of the road and those sorts of things. There's just sort of this group that really finds this type of an argument attractive.
How big is this group? How many are we talking here?
65%.
So we have right about 175 of the filings with us, and
175. Is that 65% of that, or is that?
That's the 65% of the 270 corporation souls that we have on the books today.
That you think are bogus.
The 175, yes.
I mean, and without this bill, that wouldn't hold up in court?
I think that the IRS and the Oregon Department of Revenue are able to debunk the claims and still go after the people for the taxation. That's an additional expense from our tax authorities to have to track down and chase down those tax compliance and tax dollars.
Okay.
Other questions? Thank you, Peter. That's all I have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on Senate Bill 77? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 77, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 77, and the chair would move Senate Bill 77 to the floor with a do pass. Discussion.
I think you're interfering with religion, and I think there's always a question between religion and taxation, and I don't want to go there.
Okay, I appreciate that. Senator, I guess I would disagree. I think that there is a means to do that, which it sounds like most of the current churches are choosing to go to a different thing. We're not getting in the way. It's just a different way to get to the same end for them, exempt status. More importantly to me, it's there's people out there who, it's a bit of a consumer protection, who are taking advantage of misguided individuals.
Yeah, and of course, say that money. About just about any religion.
Well, okay. I'm not going to go any farther than that, Senator. Other comments? Okay, no other comments. Motion on the floor. Is there opposition? I believe there's one. There are two. Okay, is that it? All right, so Senate Bill 77 is passed to the House floor with Senators Thompson and Girard in opposition. So we'll close on, well, I should ask, who wants to carry this one? Senator Monroe.
Sure.
Please. Senator Monroe will carry. We'll close on that. We will open on Senate Bill 297. James.
Senate Bill 297 allows applicants seeking license to practice professional engineering, land surveying, and photogrammetric mapping in Oregon to obtain qualifications for licensure in any order and make single application. Permits waiver of math, science, and engineering examination for applicants that have been licensed in another jurisdiction for 25 years or more. Enables Oregon State Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveying to refuse registration to applicants that have violated statute, rule, or standards in another jurisdiction that would be grounds for refusal, suspension, or revocation in Oregon. Identifies person in responsible charge of photogrammetric mapping work. Revises authority over fees consistent with proposed revisions. Declares emergency effective on passage. There are no revenue or fiscal aspects, impacts, nor amendments.
Thank you. Do we have a witness list?
We do.
All right, so let's see. We'll start out here with Mary Lopez, I think. Get a three for her, huh?
Okay. We're together. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and committee members. My name is Mari Lopez. I'm the administrator for the Oregon State Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveying. Thank you for letting us take this opportunity to give you information about Senate Bill 297. 297 proposes to streamline and revise the application process in order to obtain a license as a professional engineer, a professional land surveyor, or a professional photogrammetrist, not to revise the qualifications. Currently, licensure in any of these disciplines is a two-application process, and an applicant must submit two different applications with the board, and in a particular order to be allowed to sit for the required examinations. Senate Bill 297 would allow the applicant to obtain the necessary qualifications for registration, which includes sitting for the required examinations and obtaining the essential work experience in any order convenient to the applicant and prior to applying for a licensure in the state of Oregon. All applicants would still be required to meet the current qualification standards for licensure. This bill simply changes when proof of meeting the requirements of experience in examinations are submitted. Senate Bill 297 will also allow the board to waive the requirement of passing the fundamentals of engineering examination for qualifying applicants that have successfully passed the professional examination and hold an active licensure in another jurisdiction for a minimum of 25 years. The bill also allows the board to refuse licensure to applicants who have violated a statute, a rule, or professional or ethical standard in another jurisdiction that would be grounds to refuse, suspend, or revoke registration in the state of Oregon. And Senate Bill 297 also contains a few housekeeping revisions.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Girod, members of the committee, I'm Catherine Lozano, Assistant Attorney General, but I'm here on behalf of the OSBLs, not on the behalf of the Department of Justice. The department's neutral on this bill. This bill really is just a streamlining bill. The only qualifications it may change are for longtime practitioners from another state who typically have not been able to locate their records of passing their fundamental math and science exam because those records are not still retained by their state after 25 years, but they've been practicing for those 25 years or more. And the bill also corrects what is a gap in the current statutory scheme, which is that currently the OSBLs, the engineering board, can only deny licensure to people who come in from out of state if their licenses there were suspended or revoked. Whereas you often will get an applicant who maybe was an egregiously negligent or incompetent practitioner, but who entered settlement with his or her board in another state that doesn't result in revocation or suspension, then they can come in unfettered into Oregon, and that would allow the board to prevent that from happening. Thank you.
And you mark neutral. That's because you're no position, just the attorney for the board.
Okay. Correct.
Sir.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Senator Girod, and members of the committee. My name is Bill Boyd. I'm one of the public members of the Board of Examiners for Engineers and Land Surveyors. I'm just here to support the bill. It's definitely a step forward and allows the board to keep in step with the changes being made by the National Council of Examiners for Engineering and Surveying, which is moving forward into the 21st century and allows us to keep in step with them.
Okay. Questions to the panel? Senator?
Thank you. The question I have is on the fee end of it. You're taking away some of the fees, but you're increasing fees for the enrollment of engineering interns. I'm trying to understand where that plays into this bill.
Currently, the board does have the authority to establish fees by rulemaking. The fundamentals of engineering is being replaced with the engineering enrollment. So currently, an applicant would need to make application with the board to sit for the fundamentals of engineering examination. Upon successfully passing the examination, you would get an enrollment as an engineering intern. So the board currently, since 2014, because of computer-based testing, we have waived the fundamentals of engineering examination fee. There is no fee right now. But the statute would allow us establish a rule for the fee in the future, if the board chose to do that.
Go ahead.
If you're going to establish the fee, I don't like it being done by rule. I can tell you a good share of us don't like you doing it by rule, because you can set it wherever you want, and sometimes it becomes cost prohibitive and it becomes a barrier to entry. So it would seem to me like if you wanted to put it in here, I think you would get a lot more support if you put the fees in the bill, so that we can see what kind of fees you're talking about.
Okay. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Chair Beyer. It mentions in here, and you guys mentioned it, that you can waive the exam for somebody has 25 years experience. So how many people do you get that are probably got to be close to my, got to be in your 50s.
Yeah, but they'd have to
pretty close to have 25 years of experience. How many of those people that age do you get apply? Is it up? It can't be a very big number. And why was 25 years? I mean, 2015? Somebody's worked in this business for 15 years, I would think they know what they're doing, but why 25?
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, there hasn't been a lot of individuals who have applied without. This really affects those individuals who. There are other states who waive the fundamentals of engineering examination, and they sit for the PE examination in those other states and have practiced for many years in those states. However, currently, the Oregon law does not allow us to give licensure to those individuals who have actively practiced in other states without taking that first first examination. And so this bill proposes to fix that so that individuals from other states who have been practicing for so many years can attain a licensure in the state of Oregon. And we probably, I've seen maybe in 2014, there was probably about 8 or 9 people that this affected.
Okay, thanks.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Fuller. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller here this morning on behalf of the professional engineers. Mr. Kobe is here, but doesn't necessarily need to come up, the Photometric Society and the land surveyors. This is probably a really good idea. We're just still chewing on some of the same issues that you guys have discussed this morning. I think the work that Osbiel's has done, we appreciate them putting together this bill. As you know, as we build statutes over time, we add something and we take something away and we add something else, and pretty soon you have references to references, and it becomes a bit of a challenge to know what's expected of somebody that wants a professional license. So what they've done here, you'll see in the bill, there's a lot of statutes that are repealed, and they're trying to create something out of whole cloth, which we think is a really good idea. But as we sent this out to our associations, then they see things, and we're trying to relate to how they're dealing with repealing this and adding that. Ultimately, I think we're going to get to where we're really comfortable with the bill. It may need some minor tweaking here and there. We appreciate the chair scheduling the hearing, and just ask you to give us a little bit of time to put our associations together with the folks at Osbiel's, make sure everybody's questions are answered, and we'll try to answer your questions at the same time so that we can come back with something that the industry is wildly enthusiastic about. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and welcome back to Salem, by the way.
Thank you. Any questions, Ms. Fuller? Thank you, Darrell. Nope, Marsha, don't need to be there. All right, that's all I have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 297? Seeing none, it looks like we need to take a little time on this one. Senator Girard has indicated that he would like to consider working with the sponsors on an amendment that would take the fee and put it in statute. So with all of you together, we'll schedule this one back on in a couple of weeks. Give you some time. With that, we'll close on Senate Bill 292, and we'll open on Senate Bill 456. Yep. 456. James.
It's this?
Yeah.
Senate Bill 456 clarifies ability of natural gas utilities to receive additional incentives for projects approved by the Public Utility Commission under voluntary emissions reduction programs, declares emergency effective on passage. There are no revenue or fiscal impacts, nor any amendments.
All righty. How about we bring all three of you up together? Mr. Bauer, Mr. Eisendorfer, and Mr. Bissonnette. So we get the full range. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. As Mr. Fuller mentioned, it's nice to have all of you back in Salem.
You really mean that?
We hope.
He's in a minority.
You may recall that last session, this committee worked on a measure sponsored by Chair Beyer and worked on by the Public
Utility Commission. Senator Starr.
And Senator Starr as well, correct. That would allow natural gas utilities to receive an incentive to invest in projects to reduce emissions that would also benefit its customers. The bill moved forward, passed during the interim. The Public Utility Commission opened up a process both of workshops to kind of get everybody's ideas around how they should develop the rules and then follow that with a rulemaking proceeding. As that wrapped up, there was a question raised about kind of the placement of some of the language in the bill. And so the purpose of this amendment is to clarify that the Public Utility Commission has the authority to grant incentives kind of and various types of incentives to move these types of projects forward. It's purely clarifying. Everybody thinks they have that authority, but because a question was raised, we thought it would be best to just kind of come back and
want to make the attorneys happy.
Yes. I will mention, in addition to the folks here to testify, I did hear from the Northwest Industrial Gas Users Association, and they are also okay with the bill. Okay. So we urge your support.
Jason?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Jason Eisdorfer, Utility Program Director of the Public Utility Commission, basically seconding what Gary just said. This is listed as a clarification. It's really a confirmation of what the stakeholders who were part of the development of 844 thought. It's a confirmation of what the stakeholders in our six-month rulemaking process believed, and ultimately the commission came out with an order adopting those rules, basically understanding this very thing that 844 does primarily is give flexibility to the commission to grant incentives to a natural gas utility coming forward with one of these projects, a little bit separate from the traditional ways of determining return on equity. And so this language does precisely that. It makes sure that what everyone thought we were doing was is what the language says. And as Senator Beyer said, this is one of those lawyers' things. I should say that the commission order is reviewed by the Department of Justice, so they felt that the interpretation of the commission was spot on. I think this is an abundance of caution measure, but it's worth doing because this is while a modest, it's a novel approach, and I think we want to get it right.
Jeff?
Good evening, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Bissonnette with the Citizens Utility Board representing residential ratepayers. And I'll re-echo what's said. We're kind of doing what we thought we did before. We just need to do it again to be sure good bill should pass.
Super. Questions?
Senator? Sorry to ask so many questions, but that's me.
We're here.
I'm looking for the scope that this impacts. You know, we're looking, I understand the utilities and the electrical part of it, but the question I would have would be, could this money be used, for example, to create natural gas service stations? Because right now the conversion to natural gas and cars is far more efficient and cost efficient and better on the environment. So what breadth are we looking at here for these this money?
Do you want to take that one?
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, I'm in a position without having the filing in front of us, it's hard to say exactly what the scope is. I would like to say that in one sense, this is a modest bill in that there are pretty rigid requirements on the utility may come forward and show that there's a benefit to customers. On the other hand, the intent of 844, as I see it, was really to open up some of the creativity at the natural gas company. And so, frankly, this scope is ultimately what the utility can get its stakeholders around, its customers around, and come forward. There's a number of protections built into the bill, but really the intent and the scope is to see what is creative and what can work ultimately. So that's a long way of saying yes, that's a possibility, the what you've outlined.
That's consistent with the intent of the sponsors. Further questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Oh, you're the sponsor. Okay.
And was last time.
I needed
time.
To check that.
That's all I have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 456? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing. We'll open a work session. Chair moves Senate Bill 456 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion.
Oh, I should trash it, but I won't. It's a good bill.
You voted for it last time.
You looked that up.
You all did, except for Senator Riley. Seeing none, is there any objections? Yes. Senate Bill 456 is passed to the Senate floor with unanimous support. The chair will carry. We'll close on that. We will open on Senate Bill 482. And is Senator Edwards around? It's his bill. He might not be here.
Well, Thompson's here.
It's his bill, but I co-signed with him, but it's his bill.
Do you want to address it?
I don't.
He doesn't.
Let's take a 5-minute recess and see if we can call him. Okay. Has happened, and it's happened with him. Did he want to join
that
down there?
5 minutes.
Our public hearing on Senate Bill 482. James.
Senate Bill 482 enables Oregon Business Development Department Director to appoint a Pacific Northwest Manufacturing Partnership Advisory Committee to advise and make recommendations to department regarding Pacific Northwest Manufacturing Partnership and manufacturing and economic development statewide. Directs department to support advisory committee reflecting the South and Willamette Valley, Mid-Columbia Valley, and Portland Metropolitan Region. Instructs department to consult and support partnership by providing financial assistance to entities engaged in manufacturing, identifying qualified investors supporting manufacturing businesses or projects, entering agreements with higher education institutions and other economic development entities, and acting on the behalf of the partnership to apply for federal funds designated for manufacturing communities. Requires the department and advisory committee to report annually to Legislative Assembly commencing in 2017. No revenue or fiscal impacts, and there are no amendments.
Thank you. Senator Edwards, you want to head off?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Chris Edwards. I'm state senator from Eugene and representing Eugene and Junction City. That was a good synopsis of the bill, and I think we just go home. So. Oh, you want some more?
So this is your version of good bill should pass?
Yeah, good bill should pass. The staff summary well summarizes what the bill does, so I'll just fill in a little bit of background and context of how we got here. This last year, I was approached by the city of Eugene, who is here with me today, about their interest in pursuing a new approach or a new look at economic development. So we know that manufacturing communities thrive, regions thrive when all the parts of the ecosystem are in place for a healthy manufacturing ecosystem. We're talking about things like workforce and training that supports a local sector, a manufacturing sector, a manufacturing supplier network that supports that sector, research and innovation for our institutions that complement that sector. Infrastructure and site development, trade and international investment, and then resources for operational improvement and access to capital. And the U.S. Economic Development Administration has, to that end, created a program called the Investing in Manufacturing Communities Partnership. That partnership lends resources to local regions and communities that have received a designation under that program. The city of Eugene was interested in pursuing this approach and to create local manufacturing opportunities and to boost those efforts locally. They found out that, well, what do you know, a lot of other communities were interested in doing the same sort of thing. And in fact, best practices show and a lot of research shows that when local communities look outside of just their political boundaries and start working as a region to create all these elements that I just spoke of and laid out, then they have more success. And so, and that, in fact, is why the U.S. EDA has created that program. So folks at at Business Oregon convened several interested parties, folks, and there's a list. I don't know if you have the materials or not, but economic development organizations from up and down the Willamette Valley, the Columbia River Corridor in Southwest Washington, community colleges, universities, and business folks to start working in collaboration with one another on this effort. So what we have before us is the Pacific Northwest Manufacturing Partnership. This bill would codify that partnership within Business Oregon, and I think that it would go a long way toward showing the U.S. EDA that the legislature supports this approach to economic development and boosting manufacturing in our state. I think that it would also it would give it its legal framework to do its work, and of course, every program, and just having the program in place doesn't ensure that it will be successful. But I think that there are a lot of really committed individuals that just took it upon themselves to get this up off the ground. There have been committed individuals inside Business Oregon that are really committed to seeing this move forward. And as they've been asked by the U.S. EDA to tweak their application and to refine the proposal, they've been able to come to agreement. Even along that entire corridor, they've been able to find ways to agree how to move forward together, and it certainly creates efficiencies for the department in dispersing information as opportunities, federal opportunities, come forward. Finally, I would add that every region that receives this designation, that receives a manufacturing communities partnership designation from the U.S. EDA, also what they get is some. It's been explained to me that they will be looked at preferentially when applying for resources from the relevant federal agencies, and they will also receive dedicated staff from those agencies that are trained and used to working with these regions that have this designation. So that would certainly help cut through a lot of the red tape as we're trying to do things locally. For those reasons, I think this is a great bill. It's not the biggest bill of the session, but I think that it could really help our local communities build out a healthier manufacturing ecosystem in the state.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Mundorf? Is
it? Mundorf?
Yeah.
Thank you. We have a little bit of an order.
Oh, you want to go in a different order?
Sure.
I'll let you pick your own order then.
Yeah.
Lisa, it's up
good
to you.
Good afternoon, Chair Byer, committee members. My name is Lisa Gardner with the City of Eugene. The Pacific Northwest Manufacturing Partnership, or PNWP, comprises 17 contiguous counties in Oregon and Southern Washington, extending from the Eugene Springfield metropolitan region north to Portland, Vancouver, and east to Hood River and the Columbia River Gorge. The partnership is an unprecedented strategic collaboration formalized with an executive memorandum of understanding. The PNMP formed in response to a federal opportunity, as Senator Edwards mentioned, the Investing in Manufacturing Communities Partnership, or IMCP, which aims to accelerate the resurgence of manufacturing in the United States and create a competitive climate for job creation and private investment. Although formed in response to the federal opportunity, the partners agree that the PNMP will be an important tool to address economic prosperity in the region with or without the federal designation. We did not receive the designation in 2014, but the newly formed partnership has built a foundation so we can work together to achieve common goals. The PNMP reflects the growing recognition of common goals among the communities of the Valley and the Gorge. While our region's innovation and productivity are immense, we confront serious challenges. Our manufacturing workforce is aging. Our workforce pipeline is inadequate. Median wages in our region are below national averages, and there's a growing economic disparity and erosion of middle-class jobs. A high-performing manufacturing sector contains the promise of well-paying middle-class jobs across urban and rural communities. However, as the labor requirements in manufacturing increasingly resemble those of other high-tech creative industries, our regional integration must increase and our approach to investments must become more strategic. The individual partners of the PNMP face common problems. The different communities throughout the 17-county area all share the common issues of workforce, inadequate workforce pipelines, low wages, and eroding middle class. We're all working individually to confront and overcome these issues. By partnering, we can take advantage of each other's technical expertise to understand the causes of the problems and paths toward solutions. The PNMP gives us separate geographic areas a way to learn from each other's efforts and successes. By sharing expertise and workers and training platforms, we benefit each other. The PNMP region shares resources. The labor force is mobile. Education and training in one single community may be applied in a different community. In addition, we can link supply chains to manufacturers to ensure component supplies and prevent capital leakage. We can also link trading systems to access new markets. Finally, we'll also be able to coordinate funding efforts so we do not compete for funds. This is important, but able to pursue them jointly and increase chances of receiving those funds. We have prepared a one-pager. It's been uploaded to the OLIS system, and it's listed under Donna Green Salter, just for your information.
Please.
Chairman Beyer, Vice Chair Gerard, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony regarding Senate Bill 482, the designation of the Pacific Northwest Manufacturing Partnership. My name is Carl Mundorf, and I'm the Director of Research Programs for Oregon Best, which, as you know, advances innovation across the state's clean tech economy. We've been involved in the PNMP since inception, and I'd like to provide you with an example of how the partnership is already moving forward. Due to the work we've done in creating a diverse group of stakeholders, when an economic development agency economic adjustment assistance proposal was released this past September, we were able to quickly create consensus, define the team, and respond by proposing to advance the development of cross-laminated timber, or CLT. We believe CLT has the potential to revitalize our wood products industry. $200,000 project titled Advanced Wood Products Manufacturing Study, Cross-Laminated Timber Acceleration in Oregon and Southwest Washington will study a variety of aspects essential for the region to play a significant role in the adoption of CLT in the building industry. It will examine the raw material resource, the manufacturing capacity, the capital expense to start up a manufacturing line, the workforce training needs, and the market barriers, as well as the market opportunity. PNMP provided assistance with the grant writing, securing matching funds from Oregon Best, Business Oregon, OSU, Woodworks, the City of Eugene, Clackamas County, the City of Corvallis, Benton County, and the Oregon Department of Forestry. The work of the grant will be performed by Oregon Best, the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership, Impact Washington, Oregon State University's College of Business and its Department of Wood Science and Engineering, Clackamas County, Benton County, the Washington State University Center for Innovation and Value Creation, Business Oregon, as well as Woodworks and other local workforce groups. Having the PNMP allowed us to quickly assemble a strong team that created a strong competitive proposal to the EDA grant, which will benefit not only this region, but also many parts of the larger region impacted by the prolonged downturn of the wood products and timber industries in the state of Oregon and Southwest Washington. The PNMP will continue to develop and respond to our region's manufacturing community, and having official recognition by the state of Oregon will allow us to demonstrate to organizations such as the federal agencies that we are a strong regional manufacturing community, which will strengthen the economy of the region and the state by making us more competitive when it comes to responding to these other funding proposals. Thank you for the opportunity to testify to this committee on this important bill.
Thank you.
So, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Jesse Aronson. I'm with Work Systems, Inc. We are the local workforce investment board in the Portland region. And as a workforce organization, we're very supportive of the PNMP as it parallels our local sector strategy, but on a much larger scale. We've had great success in our region forming the Columbia Willamette Workforce Collaborative with our neighboring workforce boards in Southwest Washington and Clackamas County to support our local manufacturers. Through our partnership, we've been able to break down silos, leverage resources, reduce duplication of services, share best practices, and connect job seekers to industry employment and manufacturers to the talent they need to stay competitive. We've also been very successful at jointly securing resources at the federal level. Through the PNMP, the state will realize many of these same benefits. We also think the PNMP offers the opportunity to enhance the Oregon Work Ready Community Initiative. Through the partnership, we'd like to define what being work ready means for manufacturing, or to have a region designated as a work ready manufacturing community. If industry can agree on what makes an individual manufacturing work ready, workforce and education organizations will be able to more effectively prepare Oregonians to fill the living wage jobs left vacant by an aging workforce. Oregon companies will have the talent they need to grow, and Oregon communities will be desirable locations for manufacturers looking to do business in our state. So we're excited about formalizing this partnership through the bill and pursuing the federal designation as a manufacturing community. Thank you.
Much. Questions? Senator Riley?
Thank you, Chair. So all this bill does is allow the department to appoint you as an advisory committee. Is that correct?
It is correct.
Okay.
Senator Riley?
Yeah, thank you. The question I have really is from Section 2 on page 2, and I understand that you want to form a group of counties that have basically preferential treatment if you get this designation. The question I would have, say that I was a senator from Jackson County, why should I vote for this bill?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Girard, I had the same question. And the federal program does not allow an entire state to be designated as a manufacturing community for purposes of the program. So they're trying to encourage regional collaboration within states or even intrastate, as is the case here. But they do not allow an entire state to be designated in total as a manufacturing community under this program.
Would they allow more than one application?
Yes, yes, and in fact, one of the things that I think that we'll see with this is once we have the first Pacific Northwest Manufacturing Partnership promulgated by this bill, and the department gets some expertise, we'll see other regions of the state wanting to partner together to form their regions.
But why don't you just put that in the bill where you have a statute that would allow that to move forward, so that you would have Jackson County, say Southern Oregon, with Northern California or something. It just seems to me, and I just listed four, Farioli, Bates, Whitsitt, and Cruz. If I saw this and I was any one of those four, I would vote no. But that's why I don't understand why not in statute to expand it so it could be, I mean, you have your group that you want to stay whole, but you would have it so that the other groups could form on their own.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I might, so the counties and the cities that are currently involved were all independently looking at the same program, and then some folks in the Portland area, I can't remember exactly who it was, but helped connect the dots, and they said, "Well, wait, you guys are all working on the same stuff, Business Oregon. Why don't you help convene them all?" I'm told that nobody that wanted to participate was denied, that other communities have not reached out and said, well, we want to be a part of it. Passage of the bill does not preclude anybody else from doing the same thing. And it's my belief that passage of the bill and showing legislative support, one, it helps this particular region that's the pioneering region on this effort in Oregon. It will help them be viewed favorably by the federal agency. Two, I think that it will be an example by which other communities around Oregon that are contiguous to one another and want to work and work together in similar manners could do that. There's nothing in this bill that precludes other regions from taking up efforts.
But they're not mentioned specifically. Under Section 2, that's what I'm saying, is the geographic region means South Willamette Valley, and you give the counties, Mid-Willamette Valley, give the counties, Mid-Columbia Valley, give the counties, and Portland Metro, including the counties up in Washington. There's nothing that mentions, like, I'm just picking out an example, Jackson County or Gilliam County or whatever. So what I'm saying is, why can't they be part of the bill but not part of the collaborative that you wish to form?
Mr. Chair. I don't know that they can't be a part of the bill. They could not be, for federal application purposes, they could not be a part of this particular regional application. I'm not saying that a bill could not be written that defined other regions. I think, you know, one approach would be once those regions, because we can't force anybody to do this.
No.
So it takes on-the-ground community-level effort. So at the point that we have on-the-ground community-level effort from those communities, I would say we should pass bills for them as well. I suppose you could write a bill that calls out other counties and saying you can do this also, but you can't participate with these folks in this particular regional application. I think it dilutes a little bit the legislative support for this particular partnership. But I don't have strong feelings about it one way or the other. I just want to see more of this happening in Oregon, more manufacturing.
This was designated. Is there anything that would preclude other counties like Douglas County from joining in later?
Chair Beyer, I don't believe there's anything precluding them. I think as Senator Edwards spoke to the issue, there was a marriage, if you will, of three separate regions that were all preparing an application for the federal designation. We had conference calls. We invited people from across the state to participate. The three who were most interested and who had the momentum joined together to do this partnership. Of the 77 applications that the federal government received, 12 were designated. We were 13th. So we're really just right on the edge, and we believe that getting this state recognition will give us that additional indication of support from the state. And as Senator Edwards indicated, we can't have a statewide partnership. So I think what we're trying to do here is continue with the synergy and the momentum that this group has put in so far. We spent the better part of a year and a half working on this, and I think certainly it paves the way for other people to participate in the future.
Yeah, and I guess, Senator, I would just suggest that this is not that unusual. We have other things that are special. We have enterprise zones that are spread all over, not everybody, but a few here and there. We've got some special irrigation programs that are targeted just to eastern Oregon. We've got some special forestry programs that are just to southeastern Oregon. So I don't disagree with you, but it's not atypical of the legislature to do that kind of thing. Senator Riley.
Yeah, if I may, I think I can say that I believe that there's good reason for Senator Farioli and others from those areas to vote for this, because this allows some people in Oregon to actually have this, whereas if we don't, they've already been put in number 13 out of 12. And one group in Oregon is better than no groups in Oregon.
Other questions?
Chairman Beyer, if I might comment, Senator Gerard. The Pacific Northwest Manufacturing Partnership is not trying to be an exclusive organization. In fact, we have decided that other counties or organizations can join this group over time. But for this application to participate in this EDA opportunity, it's this defined geography at this point. And projects that we do gain can benefit other parts of the state. For example, the CLT application that we're doing with the EDA, the benefit region is not necessarily the PNMP, it's the rural counties of the state of Oregon.
Well, let me just throw it out back to the Jackson County analogy. you have a business that is looking to go either into Eugene or into Medford. You have this body that gives you a little bit of an advantage. Back to the question, why would somebody from Jackson County vote for it? And I'm all for Oregon. My counties are all mentioned in here. But I've done a lot of tours through eastern Oregon and rural Oregon where I'm from, and I'm telling you, it's really hard that Portland and Eugene, who are doing very well, seem to want advantages when the rest of the state is hurting badly. And so it bothers me. It just does. From a competitive standpoint for the regions that aren't doing very well.
Wow. Anybody else? Thank you, gentlemen and lady.
Thank you.
Anybody else wish to testify on this? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing, and I would open a work session on Senate Bill 42. And
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 482 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thompson has moved Senate Bill 482 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. I guess I would add this. I think I understand Senator Girard's comments on this. I would note for the record, according to the recent economic report, that Eugene is not doing as well as the rest of the state. Sort of behind the eight ball a little bit this time around. Got hit pretty hard.
Try Mill City, Oregon.
Well, if something's going to happen there, something's going to happen there. I don't think we've done a lot in the rural areas and continue to try. I mean, it's the economics. I mean, I could show you some of the mills that we've funded. No, some that we funded too, and other things. So I don't think this is. This is something that I think benefits the whole state if it works, and I'll just leave it at that. Other discussion? Opposition to the motion?
I'll vote for it. I'm holding my nose. So
we had one hold nose, but it is a Senate Bill 482 passes to the Senate floor with unanimous vote, and Senator Edwards and Senator Thompson, would you like to co-carry this?
Sure.
All right. Okay. That will close on that. And next we will open a work session, I guess it is, on introducing legislative concepts. Colleagues, again, just for the record so that everybody understands, we're proposing to introduce these legislative concepts, or legislative bills, if you will. It does not indicate a vote for or against this. We'll wait and see where they come up, and we'll see. So let me read them into the record. The chair moves the following be introduced as committee bills. LC 1133, relating to post-insurance policy and endorsements. LC 1202, relating to incentives for increasing apprenticeship utilization on public improvements. LC 1726, relating to landscape contracting work group, Senator Thompson's bill. LC 2868, relating to fees for accountants. LC 2882, relating to credit unions. LC 2883, craft industry recommendations from the OLCC task force. Discussion?
Nothing in there about fees to retired dentists?
we've apparently missed that. Is there a discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Motion passes. These legislative concepts are introduced as committee bills. We'll close on that. And is there anything else for the good of the order? Colleagues, we did good today. Starting off, we had six bills we heard. Five of them went out, and one we're carrying over for some further work, plus all the other concepts. So thank you very much. We'll have a good day, and we'll see you on Wednesday. We're adjourned. We'll see you on Wednesday. We're adjourned.